November 9th. It cost 10 cents to enter the children's zoo in Central Park, so I bought a ticket and saw a litter of albino mice gathered around their mother. There were 22 of them, newborn and hairless, pink like pencil erasers. Later, I walked to the library and came away with a new Ronnie Millsap biography. "Your mother's twin," I said to Hugh when I got home, though of course she looks nothing like him. Ronnie Millsap is blind. His grandfather's name was Homer Frisbee. Our neighbor Helen came to the door this morning holding a takeout carton filled with chicken. "Hugh" was written on top of it in big letters. The other day she brought him a pound of sausage. The day before that it was turkey meatloaf and a gallon of milk. Hugh gave her a dozen roses, but she returned them, saying she's allergic. It seems important that no one ever repays her, that the other person is always in her debt. Last week she accepted a few flashlight batteries, but that was a first. "What do you say?" she growled after handing me the chicken this morning. "You say, 'Thank you, Helen.'" She's something else, this woman. I worked for Alba, who was sick, throwing up all day. At a party last night, she had 11 Bellinis, those peach and Prosecco cocktails. These were followed by 3 tall boys. Yikes. You'd think an adult would know better. Beer on wine, you're fine. Wine on beer, stand clear. But 11 Prosecco cocktails should not precede anything. Not even a 12th. November 14th, Raleigh. Mom died last night, suddenly, of pneumonia, brought on by her chemotherapy. Amy called to tell me, and now we're all in Raleigh. Dad gave us the option of seeing her, laid out at the funeral home, but I was afraid to go. We all were. How strange to be in her house and see her things, the half-worked crossword puzzle, her mail and stockings. She didn't expect to die yesterday. Did she? When it happened, Hugh and I were in our kitchen in New York. He was making manicotti and talking about a wooden chicken he'd bought when I got socked by the weirdest feeling. I thought that Hugh was going to die, and I must have said something because he accused me of being dramatic. I can't believe this has happened. November 21st, New York. The other night we were visited by Father Regis, the new priest at the Greek Orthodox Church. He came to get an idea of what our mother was like and took a cue from the unfinished 1,000-piece puzzle spread out across the dining room table. For the past few days, we've been working on it, just something to do with our hands as we sat around talking. "Oh," the priest said when he saw us, "I see you are finishing this in the memory of your dear departed mother, God rest her soul." He made it sound so hokey. November 22nd. I had ELF training today, from 1 to 4. The film strips about safety and theft I remember from last year, but there was a new one about shoplifting, narrated by a guy in prison. The walls of his cell were scarred and ugly, and after he spoke, we heard from the cashier who had seen him steal and alerted security, thereby earning a $500 bonus. For most of the day, I sat beside Richard, whom I met last year. He's older than me, but lives with his parents. All his talk is about cute guys. November 23rd. I really outdid myself last night. After 3 martinis, 5 beers, and 2 joints, I fell asleep on the kitchen floor. There was a sofa 3 feet away, but I couldn't manage the walk, I guess. I've been getting high since Thursday, and the drinking is out of control. Since waking up, I felt like shit, headache, hot flashes, chills. And to make it worse, I spent the day on a scaffold, helping Mark and Lily paint a restaurant. I was hoping that maybe I'd fall, get amnesia, and forget that I drank. December 2nd. Someone threw up outside of Santaland and covered it over with a paper bag. I saw the bag lying there on the floor, and when I picked it up, I got vomit on my hands. December 22nd. Santaland is filthy now. I loaded a large bag with trash this morning, disposable diapers filled with crap, cans, bottles, mittens, destroyed bits of the various displays. Yesterday, a woman had her son pee into a cup, which of course tipped over. "That's fine," I said, "but Santa's also going to need a stool sample." December 31st. Before catching the plane to Raleigh on Christmas Eve, I worked. We were packed, and I photo-elfed for 5.5 hours before getting my break. At the beginning, I was paired with Santa Howard. He always asks the children what they plan on leaving him, and I laughed when a kid hesitated a moment before saying, "Matches?" Actually, for a pipe smoker, it's not a bad little gift. Christmas was hard. Luckily, Hugh was there to help with the cooking. When Mom was around, we'd remain at the dinner table for hours, but this year we all scattered the moment we finished eating. Included in this year's gifts were many things our mother had bought us, mainly from catalogs, which was rattling. Dad wants to talk about her death. He needs to. But unlike the rest of us, who yak incessantly about our feelings, he has no vocabulary for it, and is reduced to the cliches you'd find on a sympathy card. It's like not knowing a language. He also doesn't know how to shop. January 13th, New York. Looking into the future lately, I see nothing but a mess. I think I peaked in 1988. It's all downhill now. How awful to decline this way. What makes young people young is that they see themselves going up, up, up. Not me, though. I'm old now. January 15th. From 9 to 3, I moved furniture, and from 4 to 8, I sanded floors, so I'm beat, but glad to have worked and made $90. In the morning, I was with Richie and learned that he lives with a man named Herman, who is gay and has AIDS and owns a satanic supply shop. Herman has a thing for convicts and is currently courting one of the defendants in the Howard Beach case. Richie, who has been in prison himself, lives rent-free and takes care of the dogs. He has a voice like Jackie Gleason's, so it surprised me to learn that he was gay. It seems he has appeared in several pornographic movies. "I'm a top," he said. "I know everybody says that, but I really am." January 20th, Bridgehampton, New York. I woke up to snow this morning. While Hugh and Lily painted, I continued the Elvis Presley biography. Toward the end of his life, they practically needed a crane to lift him out of bed. He was so doped up and obese and out of it. His windows were covered to keep things dark. Drugs had paralyzed his colon, so he had to take lots of laxatives. Often he shit in his sleep. His bedroom smelled awful, and he hated taking baths and showers. He was just this lump, apparently, not mean or cruel. Reading the book, you can't help but feel sorry for him. If I were that wealthy, I'd probably be the same and take drugs until I died. Lying in bed last night, I imagined that Elvis said to me, "David, I need your help." So I said, "All right." And together we turned his life around. Elvis used to eat a pound of bacon every morning, along with a 6-egg Spanish omelet and biscuits. At night, he'd have many cheeseburgers and loads of mashed potatoes with gravy. He'd talk and watch TV while he ate, and when his food got cold, he'd call out for more. February 9th, New York. Hugh sat me down today and said, gently, that while I whine and sulk, I don't do much of anything when it comes to finding steady work. "Do you think that someone's going to knock on the door and offer you a job?" And I said that of course that's what I thought. Doesn't he know anything? I don't make things happen. That's not my way. Rather, I wait around and settle for whatever comes along. February 10th. Administration assistant dream job. Work for a star. Gal/guy Friday. All around executive assistant. Answer fan mail. Administrative duties, light typing. Mademoiselle, 16 East 40th Street. I saw this in the New York Times and thought, honestly, that is my dream job. answering fan mail at Mademoiselle Magazine. I shaved, threw on clean clothes, and went to apply, not feeling intimidated the way I normally do, but thinking, out of my way, this is mine. I suppose I wondered who at the magazine got fan mail, but it didn't really matter. Whatever the letter, I'd answer it. Mainly, I pictured Hugh's face when I greeted him with the news, I got a job, and it's perfect. When I arrived at the office and saw 15 other people applying, I still wasn't worried. The application asked what experience I had and listed various computer programs. Did I know Lotus? Quark? Would I be interested in paying $70 to take a class in either one of those? The room was big and we sat on a built-in sofa as the movie The Fabulous Baker Boys played on two TV sets. I heard the receptionist call someone's name, then say, "You can step in now for your typing test." Furious clattering noises came from the place where the test was being administered, and I thought, fuck. After 13 years, I can still only type with one finger. I'm fast with it, but can't lift my eyes from the keyboard. Taking a test was out of the question, so I approached the receptionist. She asked what job I was applying for, and when I said answering fan mail, she said I needn't worry. Just sit back down. When I was called for my interview, the woman, whose last name was Pizza, told me that the job was already taken. But have you temped before? That's when I realized this was Mademoiselle Temporary Services, not Mademoiselle Magazine. I told her I hadn't taken the typing test, and she said that sometimes companies just wanted someone to answer the phone. That said, they'd probably want someone with a nice voice and the face to go with it. Thanks anyway, I said. When I got back to the apartment, the phone rang. It was Dad, who told me I should try to get work as a model. I told him he was being ridiculous, and he said no, he'd just been at the barber shop and saw a GQ magazine with a guy on the cover who looked just like me. So I went to the newsstand and found a copy, and the person on the cover was not a model, but Gary Oldman. February 11th. On Friday at 2:30, I have an appointment at the World Trade Center. A part-time job moving furniture around in an office. I get these little fantasies going. Passing someplace or other. I'll think of working there. And then suddenly, it's as if I have the job. And it's a great place. Everyone's friendly and terrific. I passed the duplex on 7th and Christopher and saw a sign announcing that Wednesday was comedy night. So I came home and called to ask how it worked. Did they audition people? The guy told me to phone back the next day and talk to Colette, who runs something called Stars of Tomorrow. Hugh says that if I do it, he'll leave me. Meanwhile, Mike Tyson has been convicted of rape. I always thought of him as the sexiest guy in the world, so it's hard to imagine him forcing himself on anyone. February 12th. I applied for a job at an Upper East Side sandwich shop. The woman I spoke to was named Charlotte, and I was the fifth person she'd interviewed. I don't know who the first one was, but the three who went before me were all from Pakistan. "Why do you want to work with sandwiches?" Charlotte asked. And I thought, well, I don't, really. It's just that I need a job. Next, I went to 5 and 10, no exaggeration. It's a combination antique store slash restaurant. Waiters are required to wear wingtip shoes, suspenders, and bow ties, and it's a smoke-free business. I don't know why I bothered, really. New York restaurants want waiters who look like models. If you're not pretty, you don't stand a chance. Then there's the no-experience problem. This is Lincoln's birthday, so the library was closed. March 1st. Patrick and I moved furniture from Jericho, Long Island, to Park Slope in Brooklyn. We were near the drop-off point when I noticed what smelled like a candle burning inside of a pumpkin. Then I saw smoke coming from the back of the van and we pulled over. One of us had apparently thrown a lit cigarette out the window that blew back in and settled on a moving quilt. It burned through two layers but luckily didn't reach the tabletop. The people we picked up the furniture from in Jericho, an older couple, had a spotless house. What's odd is that they had brass knockers on all their inside doors, to the bedrooms and bathrooms, the closets, everything. Be careful, they kept saying. Watch the corner. Watch the stairs. The couple in Park Slope were in their late 30s and had a baby. They smiled a lot. Were nice. Brooklyn is covered in graffiti. Absolutely covered. March 19th. Hugh and I went to Westport, Connecticut, and picked up two tuxedo cats that used to belong to the actress Sandy Dennis, who recently died of ovarian cancer. On the train back to New York, two black teenagers were discovered hiding in the bathroom. They'd snuck on without paying, and were shocked when the conductor asked them to hand over their Walkmans, saying, "Those should about cover the price of the tickets." "You don't understand," one of the kids said. "These aren't our Walkmans." He said they belonged to friends, and that they went to a really tough school where every day someone got shot and killed. "That's not my problem," the conductor said. "But," the kid said, "but..." The conductor said they'd have to get off at the next stop, 125th Street. The other kid spoke up then, saying, "But we want to get off at Grand Central." "Look," the conductor said, "you can either get off at 125th Street or go to jail." To this, the first kid said, "Which one?" March 22nd. Patrick stayed up late last night and watched a show about termites, which don't eat wood, but apparently just store it in their cheeks or whatnot. Then they bring it back to the mound, where they use it to mulch mushrooms. Can this be true? I'm so gullible sometimes. March 23rd. According to the book I'm reading, Judy Garland was once singing Over the Rainbow at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles when a moth flew into her open mouth. She couldn't spit it out in the middle of the song, so just parked it in her cheek until she had finished. Again, can that be true? June 15th. Normally in the morning, Hugh drinks tea and eats a piece of fruit. Most often it's an apple, but this morning it was a banana that had been sitting too long on the shelf. The peel was bruised almost black, and inside it was the color of pus, all slick and nasty looking. I just brushed one of the cats and couldn't help but take the hair and arrange it just so on Hugh's seeping banana. Then I sat back and winced. It truly was disgusting. Obscene, really. June 21st. A few weeks back, my Interview magazine mention came out, and this morning I received a postcard reading, "Dear Mr. Sedaris, you are very cute, and I love what you have to say about the world. It is a crazy place, but you make it well worth it. Your admirer, Gene Snyder." The card is just what I needed. It's nutty, sure, but how nice to know that some stranger is thinking of me. June 23rd. At Coney Island, we passed a sideshow booth that featured a two-headed baby represented in four mammoth paintings. And the first he was in diapers, shaking a rattle. Then there he was, taking his first astonished steps. In the third painting, the baby seemed on the verge of a decision, one head delighted and the other one wailing. The fourth should have been the first, but wasn't for some reason. It showed the baby swaddled in a bandana, delivered by a stork that had sunglasses on. I had to see this for myself, so while Hugh waited out front, I bought a ticket and went inside. There I found the two-headed baby, not playing patty cake or scribbling on walls with a crayon, but floating in a jar of formaldehyde. Three of the four pictures I'd seen were absolute bullshit, as he couldn't have been more than a few hours old when he died. Even in a jar, that kid has out-earned me. June 24th. The postcard I received the other day, the one from a stranger, was false. Hugh wrote it, not Jean Snyder. She was someone he went to school with as a child in Beirut. It seems he typed the postcard, attached a used stamp, and extended the cancellation marks with a pencil. I really have to hand it to him sometimes. July 3rd. I stopped at a discount store on Broadway this morning, hoping to buy some floor wax remover for one of my cleaning jobs. It was the kind of place that sells everything, but under a different name. For instance, they have an all-purpose spray, but it's called Fabulous instead of Fantastic. They don't sell Ajax, they sell Apex. The store is owned by men in black turbans who asked that I check my bag on entering. I did, and when I didn't find what I was looking for, I returned to collect it. "You stole something," the security goon at the counter said. The same thing had just happened a few weeks ago, so I was furious. "Are you accusing me of shoplifting?" "You have something in your pocket," he told me. "Really?" I said. "You pretty sure of that?" I emptied my pockets, front and back. "Does your store sell keys to my apartment? Do you sell half packs of cigarettes and books of matches from a restaurant in Providence, Rhode Island? Or hey, maybe I stole my own wallet." The man said, "I can accuse you of anything I want." Later, I felt bad for emptying my pockets. I hear people all the time shouting, "You think I stole something? Call the police." I always wonder why they're making such a big deal out of it. Why not just prove you haven't stolen anything, I think. Both times this month, I've proven myself innocent, but the security goons never apologized. They just said, "Hmm." And on leaving, both times, I condemned their entire race. Fucking Koreans. Goddamn whatever people who wear turbans are. Both times I was accused, I was dressed for cleaning apartments, wearing shabby clothing and smelling like Ajax, or Apex, I guess they'd call it. Does that mean I should wear a suit when running out for supplies and change back into my rags after returning to work? Of course, this is nothing. If I were black, I'd get this several times a day, and I'd be really angry all the time. July 5th. I woke up to someone crying, "Ma! Ma! Help me! Ma! Open the door! Ma! Ma! Open the door!" It went on for hours, and the voice was odd-sounding, not like a child's, but more like a man's. I asked Helen, and she told me it's Franny, the Italian woman who lives downstairs and will turn 100 years old on Monday. Her daughter lives on the same floor and looks after her with the help of a hired Jamaican woman who comes at night and on weekends. When the daughter leaves town, Franny gets worse and screams for her mother, her brothers, her sisters, all dead. When Helen went down this morning, Franny told her to go fuck herself. "Can you beat that?" Helen said. "The language on that one. 100 years old with a mouth like that." July 23rd. I worked with Patrick, who told me that last week Richie was arrested and then released on a $100,000 bail his father paid by putting up his taxi medallion. According to Richie's story, he was coming out of a bar when two men tried to rob him. They started fighting, and after the first guy ran off, Richie hit the second in the face with a beer bottle, hit him so hard, in fact, that the bottle broke. The police pulled up to find Richie standing over the bleeding, unconscious body, and it got worse when the guy, who was now expected to be blind in one eye, fell into a coma. I would never attempt to rob Richie. First off, he's huge. He's strong, and he isn't afraid of anything. You can tell that just by looking at him. August 15th. I went to France with a passport so new it was still warm, and 5 books about serial killers. Robert Bredella, Billy Lee Chadd, Henry Lee Lucas, Jeffrey Dahmer, and Ted Bundy. The worst of them smiled when their mugshots were taken, though, it has to be said, they were all pretty bad. Interesting was how many were disappointments to their mothers, who were hoping for daughters rather than sons. One of the 5, I can't recall which as they all ran together, was sent to school in a skirt and bonnet. That sounds so old-fashioned, a bonnet. While in Normandy, we drove through the countryside, sometimes with a mission and sometimes aimlessly. The villages looked like I thought they would, tidy yards, stone houses, window boxes spilling over with flowers. Hugh's house is in La Bagotière, a hamlet. Maybe 25 or 30 people live there, nobody fancy. The G's across the road raise sheep, horses, chickens, and rabbits. They're in their mid-60s and live with Madame G's mother and Mr. G's sister, Brigitte, who has Down syndrome and spends her days at an outdoor table laying down dominoes. She wears very thick glasses, and though she doesn't talk much, she'll hold out her hand if you hold out yours first. The teenage boy next door is mentally retarded, as is Sandrine two doors up. That's a lot for a hamlet this size. 1 in every 10 people. Hugh's house is stone, and he guesses it's maybe 300 years old. As of now, there's no running water or electricity. I spent my week helping him empty it out and clean it. Plumbers and electricians came by, and I didn't understand a single word any of them said. We stayed a half a mile away in a house owned by Hugh's friend Genevieve, a pharmacist, and her husband Momo, who holds some sort of elected office. When the week was over, we went to Paris. There are any number of stores there that time seems to have forgotten. At one of them, I bought 5 rubber noses. That's 1 for every serial killer I read about while I was in France. August 20th. Today I did a cleaning job for a 42-year-old named Tommy, who was short and slight and answered the door in his robe. He wore socks as well, and the toes of them were pulled forward and flopped around when he walked. At the start of the day, he sent me to the storage place to buy 25 boxes. These were added to the 30 he already had, most of which were half full of things he had failed to unpack during the 3 years he'd lived in his apartment. One particular box contained a $2 bill, a placemat illustrating various sources of vitamin C, a book titled How to Be Funny, several manila envelopes and dozens of lists and scraps of paper with messages such as, I am denying myself food in order to grow as a person, and hunger is a state of mind, written on them. In the afternoon, he sent me to his new apartment, where I measured the windows and then went to the hardware store to buy child guards for them. Do you have kids? I asked. He said no, but was worried he might have friends over and that some of them might fall out the windows. Do you have a lot of blind friends? I asked. Tommy has 50 identical stainless steel plates, and 3 times a day he broils himself a steak. In his freezer were 200 portions of fish, each labeled with the date and what kind it was, 1/18 cod, 2/29 red snapper, etc. I asked and he explained that he had gone through a seafood phase before turning to steak. In his closet were dozens of pairs of suspenders, many of them neon-colored, along with bow ties and hats. He is an only child. His father died from drinking, and his mother lives in Massachusetts. He asked me to return tomorrow and help him some more, but either fortunately or unfortunately, I'm already scheduled to work with Bart. September 4th. Walking down 8th Avenue, I fell in behind 2 muscled gym queens. When a car alarm went off, one of them turned to the other saying, that's the Puerto Rican national anthem. Really? The other guy said. That's actually their anthem? September 5th. Yesterday, the man Richie hit with a bottle died. This according to Patrick, whom I worked with today. Richie was out walking one of Herman's dogs when the cops stopped and asked him what it was like to be a murderer. In response, Richie pounded one of the policemen in the face and knocked him out. That got him arrested again. The guy can't stay out of trouble for the life of him. He's sweet when he's sober, as sweet as they come, but he's already killed 2 people. The first murder occurred when he was a teenager. Now he's what, 30? September 27th. I went to Walker's with Marge and 2 friends of hers, a guy named Dan, who's fluent in sign language, and a woman named Pat, who just got her master's in dance history. We got to talking, and I learned that her dad was a radio celebrity at WABC from the early 1940s until the mid-1970s. The family lived in New Canaan, Connecticut, and every Christmas morning his show was broadcast live from their living room. Pat received cards and letters from listeners and rode to Manhattan in a chauffeured car to watch her father MC Circus of the Stars. Once her dad came home from work in a helicopter, and she remembers the young trees bowing in the wind generated by the blades. Pat was, at the time, horsey, meaning devoted to horses. She went on to say that her father was an alcoholic and was married 6 times, her mom being wife number 5. The drinking didn't bother me, but the umpteen marriages and the thought of all those stepsisters definitely tarnished the beautiful picture I had formed in my mind. September 29th. Patrick's truck broke down, so he's applying for welfare. He told me that over the phone today, and then he added that Richie's murder charge had been dropped. After we hung up, Hugh's friend Leslie called. She's a buyer for Barney's and leaves tomorrow for Milan and Paris. One person talks about welfare, and the next about the terrible Donna Karen collection. October 9th. While cleaning this morning, I listened to a radio call-in show hosted by a woman who helps people find things. Not missing objects, but merchandise and services. The first person to phone in was looking for denim boots. She said she'd been searching everywhere and wanted some phone numbers so she can call around before coming into the city. I have a few pairs already, but let me tell you, once they start to fray, there's not a thing in the world you can do but buy another pair. I've got regular denim boots and stonewashed, and they're both on their way out. I swear, if I can find another place that sells them, I'll buy 100 pairs. October 13th. Hugh is in Boca Raton, Florida for a job, staying at a Days Inn. I call and ask for his room, and am connected with a Vietnamese woman. We exchange a few words, and I phone the front desk again and say that I enjoyed talking to someone from Southeast Asia, but now I am ready to speak to Hugh Hamrick. They then connect me to the room of Lisa Gold, who is doing the job in Boca Raton with Hugh. I call back and tell the operator that it was great talking to Lisa. Though she lives only 10 blocks away from me in New York, we rarely see one another, so I appreciated the opportunity to catch up. Now, though, I wouldn't mind talking to Hugh Hamrick in room 412. Jesus. October 15th. The new Pakistani cashier at the Grand Union is named Dollop. October 27th. In Saugerties, we had a waitress who was for Bush. I'm voting for him because my generation does things like that, she said. My ex-husband is a shithead and a bastard with a big government pension, and he'll vote this way or that. But me, my best years were when Republicans were in office. You know what I'm saying? October 31st. We went with Ken and Taro to see the Halloween parade. My favorite costume was a very thin, dirty Santa carrying a plastic bag of discarded cans. He was accompanied by a filthy Ronald McDonald. November 25th. Helen went off this morning on the Korean grocers on the corner of Spring and Thompson. One day they charge me 40 cents for an apple, and the next day it's 50 cents. For an apple! The bastards! The girl behind the counter asked if I was going to cook a turkey for Thanksgiving, and I said, "What's it to you?" She says, "My mother's not going to make one." And I said, "Yeah, well, your mother's a lazy bastard." December 3rd. I got a call a few weeks back from a fellow named Don, who had read my Santaland story in the New York Press. He taught a high school equivalency program in the basement of the Fulton Projects and asked if I might visit his class. The kids are bound to love your writing, but reading it in front of the actual author will likely make them nervous, he said. So if you don't mind, I'll tell them you're a graduate student who's come to observe my teaching style. Then, when they're finished, maybe near the end of the session, I'll reveal your true identity. He gave me the address, so this afternoon I showed up and was introduced as James from Columbia University. Copies of the Santaland story were distributed to the students. Then Don said, "Eddie, would you like to start?" Eddie, a 22-year-old with razor-nicked eyebrows and letters tattooed on his knuckles, began. "I was at a Sound it out," Don said. "Come on, Eddie. You can do this." I had felt uncomfortable around these students. Loud and powerfully built, they had spent their break threatening one another and yelling out the windows at passing girls. They were also volatile and mean-looking, but faced with the page, they were powerless, like children. Once someone had finished his paragraph, he'd put his head down on the tabletop or walk away to see what was happening outside. Then someone else would be called on. "Snowball just leds elves on. Elves and Santas." How odd it was to to have my experiences recounted in these voices. What were you doing while I was wandering the maze or having nickels thrown at me, I'd wonder, looking at someone in a hooded, gangstar sweatshirt? And what was I doing when you got that teardrop tattooed on your cheek? It took well over an hour to complete the reading. Don congratulated the group on a job well done, then folded his arms and leaned back in his chair. "All right," he said. "So, if you could meet the person who wrote this, what would you ask?" The guy next to Eddie put up his hand. "I'd ask, yo, is you a faggot or what?" December 15th. Ira Glass called to say that Morning Edition would like to broadcast my Santaland diary. They'll pay me $500 and give him $200 to produce it. So tomorrow, I go to a recording studio. December 24th, Raleigh. Yesterday morning, my story aired on NPR's Morning Edition. Ira and I had been on the phone the night before, trying to decide which cuts to make. I have an allergic reaction to my voice, but the singing was all right. Hugh's friend Marion phoned after the 7:40 broadcast and said how much she liked it. A minute later, I got a call from a switchboard operator who was late for work on account of sitting in her parked car and listening to me. She said she'd already phoned NPR to say good things, but thought she'd reach out to me as well. They played the story again at 9:40, and then I was called by William, Alan, and several strangers. The moment I'd start talking to someone, call waiting would act up. At 10, I left for the first of today's 4 cleaning jobs, and when I returned at 6, my machine was full of messages, most of them from people I don't know who'd looked me up in the phone book. A woman from Oregon called, a guy who runs a theater in Philadelphia, a writer for a TV show. 2 NPR stations left messages saying they were flooded, their word, with calls from people wanting to get in touch with me. A stranger from Rochester called, stuttering, asking for a tape. It was all I ever wanted. Then Hugh and I left for the airport. January 16th, New York. Helen's 42-year-old nephew was a public school teacher, and today he died of AIDS. I said I was sorry to hear it, and Helen said, "The bastard, thought he was Mr. Big because he had an education. But where's him and his college degree now? In the ground, that's where. Last time I saw him, I called out, 'Tommy!' But he kept on walking. I say, 'Fuck you, Mr. Smart.' Yeah, we all know how smart he was now." February 24th. This was an amazing New York day. In the morning, I met with Jeff Klosky, the editorial assistant from Little Brown, who called a few weeks back to ask if he could read my manuscript. He's only 23, a kid, and he has a grandmother in Jacksonville, North Carolina. We had coffee, and afterward he took me to meet his boss, Roger, a big, good-looking chain smoker, who said that he too liked my manuscript and hopes to get back to me within a week or two. Afterward, I went to our play rehearsal for Stump the Host. We open a week from tomorrow. March 8th. The night before the play opened at La Mama, William dropped out, saying he wasn't having much fun. And if it's no fun, why bother? I spent some time panicking, and then decided to take the part myself, seeing as I know the lines. So I performed on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Opening night, we had 14 people in the audience. On Friday, there were 40, and on Saturday, we were sold out. Merrill has extended our run, and thankfully, Paul Dinello has agreed to take over my part. Hugh and Amy say, "Oh, you know you love being on stage." But they're wrong. I don't. Not like that, anyway. March 9th. Roger Donald called from Little Brown to say he would like to negotiate a 2-book deal. To celebrate, I bought a denim shirt and thought it amazing how quickly one's life can change. I never thought I'd want a denim shirt. March 13th. I met on Thursday afternoon with Don Congdon, the agent Roger Donald recommended. He proposed lunch and took me to La Madre, an Italian place near his office and the fanciest restaurant I've been to in New York. Don is in his late 70s and was very elegantly dressed, a fine suit, a poochie tie, a top coat, even a black beret. The maitre d' knew him. "Right this way, Mr. Congdon." Our waiter poured olive oil onto a plate and then gave us bread, which I guessed we were supposed to dip into it. I had thinly carved steak arranged into a turban with grilled radicchio and endive. Don had pasta that he didn't finish. While eating, I learned that he represents William Styron, Russell Baker, Ellen Gilchrist, and Thomas Berger. He represented Lillian Hellman for a production of The Little Foxes in, I think, Russia, and Frank O'Connor. He told stories about wandering through the village with J.D. Salinger, whom he called Jerry, and recounted the night the two of them went to hear Billie Holiday. I heard of the time Don was arrested by the vice squad during Prohibition, and then something about Dashiell Hammett. The problem was that it was all about the past. That said, I liked his language, especially his old-fashioned slang. April 30th. Between cleaning jobs, I bought a coffee and sat in Union Square Park to read for a while. The benches there are sectioned off with armrests, this to prevent people from stretching out and sleeping, I imagine. I just lit a cigarette when a guy approached, wiry, around my age, wearing soiled white jeans and a Metallica t-shirt. His hair fell to his shoulders, he had a sketchy mustache, and he was carrying a paper bag. Ex-convict, I thought. It was a snap assessment, but I'm sticking by it. The guy asked for a cigarette, and when I handed him one, he took it without thanking me. Then he pointed to my bag of cleaning supplies, made a sweeping gesture with his hand, and said, "I'm going to sit down there." There were plenty of other benches, so I said no. "God damn it," he said. "I told you to move your fucking shit." I got up and left, knowing that if I hadn't moved my bag, he would have thrown it. If, on the other hand, I had moved it, he would have sat beside me and continued asking for things. All afternoon, I thought about it and wished that I knew how to fight. May 2nd. Yesterday, I rode my bike across the bridge to Brooklyn. On the way back, I got a flat tire, so I was beat by the time I returned home. This morning, I looked in the mirror beside our bed and saw a whale, a fur-bearing one, looking back at me. A very tired, fur-bearing whale with a cat beside him. The cat looked familiar. May 12th. Bart and I went to Long Island City to clean the loft that was used to film a recent Marilyn Chambers movie. The crew finished yesterday, and I went expecting to find a lot of semen. On our way, Bart told me that many years ago, while working in fashion, he was sent on business to Tucson. One thing led to another, and on his second night he wound up drunk and stranded. It was downtown, late, and as he tried to find a cab, a car stopped and offered him a ride. The people inside were Mexican, so he brought out all his high school Spanish, saying, "Muchas gracias, and su automóvil es muy grande y bonito también." The driver passed Bart's hotel and took him into the desert. There, the group of four beat Bart beyond recognition. They broke his nose, they held him down and kicked him in the ribs and stomach. They drove Bart's bloody face into the dirt, and when he ran away, he fell into a cactus. One of the men had taken his room key, so while Bart crawled bleeding across the dark road, they went to his hotel and stole everything. Afterward, his nose was so swollen he couldn't wear glasses. The medical report stated his blood alcohol level, and when his boss learned of it, he fired him. The loft was the entire floor of a building owned by an interior decorator. A pale fellow with a ponytail gave us a roll of paper towels, some Windex, and a spray bottle of oil soap. It wasn't much, but aside from two sofas and a copper bathtub, the loft was empty. I swept for an hour and a half, then mopped for an hour and a half. While mopping, I imagined that I was in the Navy and was cleaning a battleship. When that wore off, I pretended that this was my loft, though it only lasted for a few minutes as... who wants to live in Queens? The only thing I came across was a small triangle of fabric attached to some fishing wire. It was smeared with makeup, so I guess it was, what, a costume? May 20th. This morning, Bart told me about a woman he used to clean for. "The filthiest house I've ever seen," he said. I asked how filthy, and he told me that the first time he vacuumed her carpet, he collected $38 in change. He knew the exact amount because he kept it. June 10th. At around midnight, Hugh and I took a walk, ending up at the park on Thompson and Spring, where we sat and ate some ice cream. As we were doing so, two young men came around the corner. One of them said to the other, "I need to talk about this shit now." To punctuate, he used his elbow to smash the window of a parked car. The guy's friend walked to an empty table, and after standing there for a moment and rubbing his elbow, the guy who'd smashed the window joined him. I came home and called the police, who said, "Would you like to leave your name, ma'am?" The police always think I'm a woman. June 19th. I talked to Paul this morning. While on the phone, he told me he was scrubbing his toes with a pumice stone, trying to rub away some magic marker. "Why do you have magic marker on your toes?" I asked. He told me that on Thursday night he'd attended a Live After Five concert on the Mall in Raleigh. There he had 5 beers. These were followed later by shots in some bar. And that's the last thing he remembers. The next day he was covered with magic marker. His friends did it. And though it's a pain to wipe off, he still feels lucky. "Last guy who passed out had a bullseye painted on his butt and a Cheeto stuffed up his asshole." June 21st. Amy has moved into a new apartment in Chicago, and last night she called to tell me about it. She lives above a husband and wife, a couple in their mid-40s who are taking care of their infant granddaughter, Amber. The woman, Brandy, has a shag haircut and several tattoos, one of which reads, "Brandy Loves..." The name has been rubbed out. Her son is 25, and his wife walked out on him after the baby was born. "And you never saw her again?" Amy asked. "Oh, she came around once, but my son beat the shit out of her. I told her to never come back," Brandy explained. The son is now planning to marry a 30-year-old prostitute. "I told him if you find a good piece of ass, you should stick to it." Brandy has trouble sleeping and often comes up to complain about the noise Amy makes. Yesterday she said, "If you don't turn down that radio, I'll break your legs." June 22nd. Last night I went to the park to buy some pot. I told Hugh I was walking to the store for milk, but my long absence must have tipped him off. I came home to find a sign taped to the front door of our apartment that read, "No drugs." He put up the chain, and I explained through the crack that I had gone for milk and run into Dale on the way back. "And what did you two talk about?" he asked. "Oh, this and that. The only Dale I know is an obese, ragged-looking dog Hugh and I saw in the park a few months ago. It was me who decided that's what his name was, and I refer to him all the time. I got another letter from Dale, I'll say. He told me to tell you hello. I should have thought of another name, as this did nothing to get me back into the house." July 1st. Because of the radio, the New York Times is doing a profile on me. Yesterday, the reporter called Amy, who said, "I'm not telling you shit about that son of a bitch until he pays for that abortion he made me have." July 2nd. I was drunk and stoned, watching the 24-hour Twilight Zone marathon at 3 a.m. when a commercial came on. The man in it pointed his finger at me and said, "What are you doing, watching TV this time of night? You're drunk, you're stoned, you're a wreck, and you're destroying the lives of everyone around you." It was like he could see me. 1994, January 8th, New York. Stitches, our play, opened Thursday night to an audience of 50. La Mama can squeeze in 120, so this wasn't so bad. Friday was sold out, as was this evening. The Times came last night. Tonight it was Newsday and The Voice. I want to tell them we were just joking. It's not a real play. It's what comes from doodling while you're holding a bong. Whatever they have to say, it's out of my control now, and in the hands of the actors. My job is to play the host and greet people at the door as they enter. January 11th. It seems that Amy and I have pulled this off. Today the reviews came out in the Times, Newsday, and The Voice. Newsday was great, and said good things about everyone, especially Amy. The Times criticized the play for being too long, but other than that, the review was fantastic. La Mama has extended our run and said that several producers have called about possibly moving us to a bigger theater. I can't believe people took us seriously. Amy and I got everything we wanted from this show. The Talent family name used in reviews, big crowds, an extension. Since opening week, we've cut out 7 minutes and rewritten 2 scenes. This is just the happiest day. January 18th. The New York Daily News review came out yesterday and reads, in part, "As any 9-year-old can tell you, there's nothing quite so funny as a face hideously deformed by bungled plastic surgery, unless it's the spectacle of an amputee trying to play the guitar. For those of you who are forever 9, the greatest gross-out in New York right now, the show in the worst possible taste, is Stitches." January 30th. 6 people walked out of the show Friday night. They were all over the age of 60, and noticing them in the lobby as they collected their tickets, I thought how nice it was to have such a wide range of ages in the audience. As they left, I heard one of them on the stairs saying, "You'd have to be a moron." February 26th. I went to the corner to buy Helen some cigarettes, and when I returned, she sat me down to discuss the Winter Olympics. "Did you see it on TV? That Tonya Harding. I never liked her. She's a street fighter is what she is, a dirty snot. Nancy Kerrigan I like, but not that street fighter." Tonya Harding really is something else. I resisted the story until I saw a picture of her. With her fierce makeup, she looks like a child's drawing of an angry babysitter. Whatever else, she succeeded in capturing my imagination. She doesn't strike me as mean. Rather, she seems like the type to whom everything is unfair. February 28th. Helen knocked this morning and asked me to mail some shit for her, literally. "It's a stool sample," she said. April 4th. On the radio today, I heard a story about an American living in Singapore who was convicted of spraying graffiti on parked cars. As punishment, he's been fined and sentenced to a caning. An official described the process. A pad is placed over the kidney so as not to cause serious damage. We tell the men to aim for the buttocks. American diplomats are trying to appeal the punishment, but I think it's reasonable enough. Spray paint cars, and the least they should be able to do is spank you. April 19th. At the library, I found Pimp, The Story of My Life, by Iceberg Slim. It's the kind of book you have to read from the beginning, otherwise you can't understand the slang. One chapter is titled To Gain a Stable, and in it he teaches you how to turn out a whore by breaking her will. He suggests beating her with a straightened-out coat hanger. April 22nd. All Helen talks about is her pain. Every time I see her, she goes on, and I'm tired of it. Other people's pain is uninteresting. My own, though, is spellbinding. I went to bed at midnight and didn't fall asleep until 7 a.m. My knee hurt so much I couldn't do anything but moan. While awake, I read an entire issue of The Source, which bills itself as the magazine of hip-hop music, culture, and politics. My favorite bit was an interview with Warren G. "I was finished with almost the whole album, but I took everything back," he said. "Now I can have DJ Pooh and Cutie3 and Bobcat and all of them see how it sounds compared to what I had. I ain't with all that bullshit. You know, the shit how motherfuckers be trying to punk motherfuckers and shit. I ain't with that shit." May 5th. As part of the publicity I'm doing for the book, Barrel Fever, I was interviewed and photographed for Avenue magazine. The talking part I'm fine with, but I hate having my picture taken. First, the photographer had me pose with Dennis, my cat, while wearing a cat mask. Then she had me pretend to hang from the antlers in the living room. Next, I was told to close the louvered doors on my neck and then to hold my freeze-dried turkey head up to my nose. Just as she was running out of film, the photographer said, "Can we try something silly?" May 10th. Walking down Broome Street, I saw a couple massaging their Labrador retriever's asshole. Then the man stuck his finger in and coaxed out a clot of shit. He wasn't wearing gloves or anything. Dog people. May 14th. I met with Dawn Erickson at a cafe tonight. Though we've written back and forth, we haven't seen each other since Kent State in 1976, and because she doesn't smoke and has never had a drink or taken any drugs, she looks just the same. I learned that she still designs fabrics, that she travels a lot, mainly alone, and that her mother has cancer. Her father died 14 years ago in a skydiving accident. She still doesn't drink coffee, so she just had water. Afterward, I went to the Grand Union and was shopping for dinner when a young man touched my arm. "Hey, watch where you're going. You almost hit my baby in the head with your basket." "I'm sorry." The guy had a shoulder-length mane of carefully styled hair and wore sweatpants with the back torn out. I thought I was seeing fur underwear until I realized it was his hairy ass showing. "You almost hit the baby," he repeated. I said, "Almost, but I didn't, right?" He was just looking for a fight. In fact, I'd been nowhere near the baby. I watched from behind as he got in line, and then listened as he accused the cashier of overcharging him. The manager was called, and I wondered how anyone could go out in public like that, with his ass hanging out. I should be okay with it, but it's never the ass I want to see. June 21st. They were boarding my flight to Indianapolis yesterday when a Russian man in a wheelchair rolled up, accompanied by his family. "Can't he walk?" the gate attendant asked. When she realized that none of them spoke English, she repeated herself, only louder, "Can't he walk at all?" As I passed the man, I noticed that his pant legs were empty, that he was either an amputee or had been born this way. "Well, could he walk if he tried?" the gate attendant, who was not nearly as observant as I am, asked. July 1st. Today I cleaned for the R's. They're nice people, but incredible slobs. Every week I find something new the sun has decided to use as an ashtray. Today it was a paper cupcake jacket. I mean, really, what's wrong with the saucer? Another thing they're big on is drop change. This afternoon I found pennies in one bathtub and dimes in another. July 9th. It's hot and icky here, so Hugh and I went to the air-conditioned Museum of Television and Radio and watched TV all day. First came an hour-long tribute to women in comedy. During this, we sat behind three elderly women, one of whom kept turning around and scolding me for resting my knees on the back of her chair. I did this once. That was it, I swear, yet she kept nagging me. A fly could have landed on this woman's seat back, and she would have felt it. The third time she turned around, I told her to fuck off. I don't think she heard me, but still, I was ashamed of myself for having said it. July 11th. On the news, we saw a story about brown tree snakes in Guam. They're long, these things, and aggressive, and not too bright. The report showed a human baby one of them had tried to eat. The child weighed 15 pounds, the snake, 2. They come up through people's toilets sometimes, and one bit a man on the testicles. According to the report, the snakes are spreading. One was found in Texas. When things get bad in New York, I remind myself that at least there are no snakes here. Rats, but no snakes. July 15th. Hugh and I went to Dixon Place, and now I want to be reimbursed for those 2 hours of my life. We'd gone to see Lily sing and play guitar, and had she been the only one on the bill, it would have been fine. Sadly, there were several other acts. The first and worst was a woman named Estelle. I wouldn't call her a dancer, rather she pranced, while a second woman read a poem and a third batted pots and pans with a stick. The three of them wore something akin to war paint. If they were trying to scare the enemy, it didn't work. If they were trying to entertain the audience, it didn't work either. Estelle twirled in circles. She skipped and flailed her arms and then threw herself onto the floor. Unfortunately, she picked herself back up and began again from the top. It was my worst nightmare of performance art. She was followed by a thin, bearded troubadour. This next song is about illusions and falsifications, he said at one point. I think you all know what I'm talking about. He had either a great voice or a terrible one. I couldn't quite tell which. August 25th, La Bagotière, France. Hugh and I left Scotland yesterday afternoon and got